I want to talk about a couple of things, and maybe they'll have a connection. One is I want to acknowledge the death of Tetsugen Bernie Glassman last weekend. He struck quite a figure in our Zen world. He died at age 79, but had a long career, mainly in New York. He was from Brooklyn and came to UCLA for college, and he was interested in Buddhism and read a lot. And then decided he wanted a teacher, and that was just about the time that Maizumi Roshi was starting Zen Center of LA. So Bernie Glassman was one of Maizumi Roshi's early students, and ultimately was one of his 12 Dharma heirs that formed the White Plum Lineage, they called it. And Bernie then, after he received Dharma transmission and was given permission to be a Zen teacher, he went back to New York and started the Zen community of New York that had quite a social action bent to it. Within a few years, we're now kind of in the late 70s, he started the Greystone Mandala, which was a series of bakeries in Yonkers that was originally kind of like the Tassajara Bakery in San Francisco. It was originally staffed by Zen students as a way of kind of supporting the temple, and I think they lived there, so they supported themselves. But it grew and grew, and they turned it into kind of a vocational training for people that were homeless and people that were just out of prison. And the organization grew quite a bit. They got the contract to provide brownies for Ben and Jerry's brownies and cream, and they're making $30 million a year now, not just from Ben and Jerry's, but this variety of bakeries in Yonkers. I mean, but of course, you know, in Manhattan, you can. It costs $10 to buy a brownie, it's easy to make a lot of money in the baking business when you're selling to Manhattan. Then he decided to call his Zen center the Peacemaker Order. A big part of which was just bearing witness to the world as it is. And they did a series of sesshins, retreats, at Auschwitz, for instance. And then in the United States they did street retreats where you signed up to be in sesshin, and you just wandered the streets throughout the day, and you met in the park, a designated park, a few times during the day to sit, and if there was room at the shelter that didn't kick out a homeless person from the shelter bed, they stayed in shelters, or else they just camped out, and they did these street retreats. in not only New York, but in big cities throughout the United States. So social action and sitting was a big connection for Tetsugen Bernie Glassman. Towards the end of his life, he took off his robes, stopped being a priest, and founded an order of clowns. That what did he call it?
An order of disorder.
Yeah. That whose goal was just to make people happy. And in the midst of that were Dharma circles. He didn't think there needed to be Zen teachers. That if people practicing just got together and talked, that was the Dharma, and formed a relationship, formed a Sangha. He did designate these peacemakers, these Dharma circle heirs. He did designate facilitators, but kind of just felt that just talking about the world as it is, sitting and just acting out of the world as it is, as a community, was what he wanted to practice. So quite a renovator, and quite an active guy throughout his life. One of the books that he wrote was Instructions to the Cook. This is his commentary on our founder, Dogen. Dogen wrote a chapter in the 1200s called Instructions to the Cook, Tenzo Kyoken. And this is Bernie Glassman's commentary on that fascicle, that chapter. I'll read a little bit of it. This is a whole chapter on kind of the whole meal, starting with first cleaning the kitchen before you start cooking, and then getting into cooking, and then serving and eating. And this chapter is called Clearing the Table and Cleaning Up. Fast. There is a koan about a monk who comes to Zen Master Joshu and says, "Please give me a practice." Joshu answers, "Have you eaten your meal?" Which means in Zen talk, "Have you tasted enlightenment?" The monk says, "Yes, I have eaten a meal." "Good," Joshu says, "then go wash your bowls." Joshu's wash your bowls was pointing out that enlightenment should not leave a trace, but he was also pointing out that it is very difficult, if not impossible, to eliminate all traces. It's like the tortoise in another Zen story. The tortoise always leaves footprints on the sand, and then the tortoise's tail wipes away the footprints, but then the tortoise's tail leaves tail prints. So it's almost impossible to eliminate all our traces. We may eat all our food, clean the counters, wash the dishes, and scrub the pots. But then we have to wipe the soap off the counters and clean the sinks. And then we find ourselves left with dirty sponges. And as we look back, we notice we've tracked some dirty water onto the clean floor. In the same way, as we drop the conditioning or attitude that keeps us separated from the next thing, that very process creates a certain amount of conditioning, and then that has to be dropped away too. Wash your bowls is about this process. Even though it may not be possible, we should try to leave no trace of what we've done. Therefore, we don't walk around saying, I've been enlightened, I've made this great product, like the brownies. If your enlightenment is genuine, it will express itself in the way we act in ordinary life. In Zen monasteries, after the monks have eaten everything that's in their bowls, they clean the bowls with tea or plain hot water. Then they drink the water. The water that's left over in the bowls goes back into the gardens. This traceless, nothing less left over has a very profound spiritual meaning, but it also has a very practical ecological application. If there's any trace left over, it should be used again and again until nothing is left over. If you're a manufacturer, you have to take into account what happens to your product after it's used up. You have to think about how your product will go away. Whether you create a new car, a new refrigerator, or a cookie tin, you have to create a way for your creation to be recycled. Leaving no trace is what Zen calls non-duality. Subject and object collapse. The distinction between helper and those who are being helped disappears, as does the distinction between giver and gift, or cook and guest. Actually, Dogen doesn't suggest that we cook our whole meal and then clean up at the end. He tells us that no trace should happen as we're doing it, so that nobody knows what we've done. So we clean up while we're cooking. We eliminate traces as we go. And yet at the end, there's still a stage of cleaning up. We still have to clean the kitchen, is what he means. Just as there is in the beginning. Although we've created the stage of no trace, although we're going to start all over, we start with cleaning up, even if we walk in and everything looks clean already. Even though we may feel very calm in a deep state of concentration, the way of the Zen cook is to always start with a little centering and return to beginner's mind, so that we can clean up and take stock of our ingredients. And now we're ready to begin again. Of course, this is the end of the book. Quite a guy and a prolific writer. Leaving no trace is what Zen calls non-duality. Helper and those being helped disappear, as does the distinction between giver and gift, cook and guest. I'll smoothly segue into the transmission story, the koan on which Sekito Kisen became a Zen teacher. Sekito was the 8th Chinese ancestor. He lived in 700 to 790. And he all these transmission stories were collected by Keizan Jokin Daisho in the transmission of the lamp. So all their stories, how they got to be a monk, how they got to be a Zen teacher, are described in this transmission of the light, transmission of the lamp. And Keizan calls him self-confident. Another transmission of the light was written by Lex Hickson. Lex Hickson was a Dharma heir of Tetsugen. So here they are, together again. Lex Hickson says Sekito was intense. As a child, he broke up hunting parties so that they didn't go out and shoot animals. And he went into the monastery in his early teens to study with the sixth ancestor, Wei Ning, the famous sixth ancestor of China, who kind of brought it all together and established really started establishing Zen in China. It was called Chan, of course. And so as a youngster, he was studying with Wei Ning, the sixth ancestor. And after a couple of years, the sixth ancestor was dying. And the sixth ancestor, he asked the sixth ancestor, well, what am I going to do? Who will I study with? And of course, it was already in the works for there to be a seventh ancestor, whose name is Seigen Gyoshi. He was already established, and the sixth ancestor recommended that Sekito, still a teen, go study with him, which he did for many years. He was quite an intense monk, as we've heard, quite a sitter, sitting night and day for days on end, serious and intense, a gunner. In high school, the people who always kind of read the chapter ahead and were prepared on the first day of that chapter, we called gunners. So Sekito was quite an intense sitter and an intense practitioner. And he goes in for a discussion with the seventh ancestor. And this is a story about a whisk. So I thought I'd show you what a whisk is. We use these whisks for like our most formal ceremonies. You know, we walk in like this. We do a little movement. Only for a couple of ceremonies in a whole year here do we use our whisks, us Zen teachers. And so you know that whenever the whisk is brought out, something big is going to happen. And so if you go in to sit with your teacher and there's a whisk in the room, it's a very different kind of dialogue. You know that you're not going to talk to him about, you know, my leg falls asleep when I sit. What should I do about that? You have this very, very profound Dharma dialogue when there's a whisk in the room. And we'll use this a little later. So the dialogue, I'll read Lex Hickson's version of the dialogue. The master is the seventh ancestor, and the successor is Sekito Kisen, who we're looking at. So the master asks, "Where are you from?" Sekito replies, "From your own monastery." I mean, they were Dharma brothers until the sixth ancestor died, so that was sort of obvious to Sekito. "From your own monastery." The master raises the whisk. "Does this exist in the monastery?" And Sekito replies, "Not in any monastery, nor even in the sacred land of India." The master says, "Since when did you go to India?" The successor replies, "Only if I went to India would this exist there." Only if I went to India would this exist there. The master said, "Outrageous statements are not enough. Tell me more." Sekito said, "You can't rely on me to say everything. You must say something." The master says, "I am not refusing to talk. I just feel concerned that after me, no one will really be awakened." Sekito says, "Future successors will certainly be awakened, but they may be unable to express it." At the moment these words came forth, the seventh ancestor strikes the destined successor with the ceremonial whisk. The vessel of light, meaning Sekito, suddenly awakens beyond every level of awakening, empowered to express total awakeness fully for all future beings. So what a story. The outrageous line was about I and this, and it wasn't meaning so much this, it was meaning this. What is the existence of all of this, and how do I fit into it, or is there an I? Kazan goes on to say that up until he felt that whisk, he was still thinking that there was a whisk up there, that there was a separation between him and the seventh ancestor. He had not yet dropped body and mind to experience the non-duality of this, of just this moment. He was such an intense guy. He was still saying, where do I go with this? You know, how can I show my understanding of the non-conceptual awakening? I can't say it with words. Maybe I'll just tell him that, maybe maybe there'll be enlightenment, but we just won't be able to say it with words. Maybe that'll get me by. He was being very intense. And then he feels just this soft horsetail across his head. I like the way Lex Hickson says it. I have to put on my glasses. There is no way to strike a hard blow with a whisk. That's the way Lex is commenting on this. There's no way. With the softness of this whisk, the supercharged intensity of the destined successor is melted. His fierce atmosphere of awakeness, which, in the words of Kazan, he's kind of using Kazan as a reference as he's writing his own book. The fierce atmosphere of awakeness, which in the words of Kazan, quote, could easily demolish heaven and earth, end quote. That's how intense Sekito's sitting was. Just days and days of sitting facing the wall. And the Kazan said he was demolishing heaven and earth. His sitting was so intense. This fierce atmosphere of awakeness transformed from storm to calm with the soft caress of this whisk. So, Kazan said that at that moment, he was one with the whisk. He didn't just see the whisk. He didn't just say, uh-oh, we're going to have a deep conversation here because there's a whisk in the room. He didn't just bring in all of his ideas about the whisk. He didn't just say the whisk is made of horse tails and lacquered wood. With all the history of the great ceremonies, it wasn't until he felt that whisk across his head did he really experience the whisk and was not separate from the whisk. And all those stories dropped away and he just felt the whisk against his head and all of that anxiety. What do I say now? What do I say now to express the intensity of my practice all these years? All of that anxiety just faded away with just the whisk, just feeling the whisk at that moment. He said a pretty good deal. You know, it's not a bad answer to say that there's going to be enlightenment. But we just won't be able to express it. That's a pretty good understanding. There was still separation in the room. It wasn't until the blow with the whisk, the caress of the whisk, was their unity and non-duality. His spiritual interior is experiencing difficulty. This is before the whisk. His spiritual. No, I need to paraphrase. Sekito was experiencing difficulty with the free, generous expression of awakeness which perceives enlightenment everywhere, not just in the realm of transcendent realization. Not just sitting in meditation, for instance, but enlightenment is everywhere. Sekito is subtly and unconsciously blocking the flow of total awakeness with his intensity. So this actually is the whole of our Zen practice. How do I remember to see enlightenment in everything? How do I see the body of Buddha in this book, in this clock, in this whisk, in this body? When I can see this body of Buddha in all things, then there's no separation. That's the deal with being a Buddha, is that you're not separate from anything, and so everything is one, non-dual, no cook and guest, no helper and being helped, and that's a practice that we can maybe get confident in on the cushion, but Zen, our practice is to take that no separation, that free, generous expression of awakeness throughout our lives, and not see separation between people that we're working with, friends and family. This is our non-dual practice. Sekito wrote his most famous poem, The Merging of Difference and Unity, the day after he experienced the whisk that separate things are united. And we're studying his second poem on Sunday mornings, The Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, where he's kind of changed his tune. This softness really kind of softened him up. He really sat with a little more ease and taught about ease rather than so much intensity. The poem starts out saying about a monk, "I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap." So it starts out pretty relaxed. Sekito has changed his tune. This monk in the hut becomes this metaphor for our practice, our minds, our hearts, our bodies. And at some point he says, this monk in the hut is a shining window below the green pines. And we're encouraged to use the light of that window to illuminate all things in our lives as nothing but enlightenment. When we shine this candle in the hut, when this candle in the hut is illuminating all the things, can we see everything as the body of Buddha, as enlightenment? Can I meet the clerk at the store as nothing but the body and mind of Buddha, as nothing but enlightenment? Can I go downtown and pay the county tax collector my property tax and say, what a Buddha, the body and mind of Buddha right there. Of course I want to give you my tax money. We recognize that the only living Buddha is this. So this is where the I and the this come back. That Ben Connolly is we're looking at Ben Connolly. He's a teacher in Minnesota. We're looking at his commentary on this Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. And he says that the poem is about life, a life of profound ease and moment-to-moment engagement with life. Can we profoundly engage with this, with all that is right before us, with profound ease, and realize the enlightenment in all of that? This is our practice. What would it mean to be profoundly at ease throughout the day? I think we'd have to really accept everything that comes to us, not out of fear or not out of resistance, but to be really at ease. We have to let go of all of our fixed ideas about who my coworker is, why we think the store clerk is so slow today. We have to let go of all of that, all of those ego stories, and be totally comfortable with being intimate and close with whatever approaches us in this moment. That's the profound ease that Sekito describes, building this comfortable, warm hut in the middle of the forest, all by himself. Just that candle illuminating everything. Profound, and I think that's what we can do on our cushion. The practice that we do on our cushion is learning fearlessness of dropping body and mind, of dropping the ego. I think I'm a pretty special person, and I've learned a lot. I've worked hard to learn a lot. But that's sort of this, my ego's story. Can I drop all those habits for the sake of really becoming intimate, of really opening my heart? And isn't that how we all would like to live? Open-hearted, intimate, fearless, connected. So it's a payoff. It might pay off if we can cultivate that fearlessness, which is not different than cultivate that kind of profound open-heartedness and ease, so that we can have moment-to-moment engagement with our life. And this, Lex says, Lex Hickson, is the only living Buddha is this moment, the totality of this moment. Both of them write a verse. To kind of summarize the story of each ancestor, Keizan Chokin in the 1300s writes this: with one raising of the whisk, he held up the totality of the way. Never by so much as a hair did Sekito ever deviate from it. Sekito, turn to the life of ease and intimacy in exchange for his self-confidence and intensity, and didn't deviate. It was the totality of the way he saw, this profound ease and moment-to-moment engagement with just this. Lex Hickson finishes this chapter with, just by sitting and looking, you are raising the horsehair whisk. Now strike such a delicate motion. Of course, it has to be this way. Laughing, I feel the ancient whisk in my hand. So, this has been about, how do we relax and meet each moment with an open heart? And this is what our practice is about. We've got just a couple of minutes. Maybe you've got some ideas about this practice. Nettie.
Thank you.
Um, Bernie Glassman was a little intense. I don't know what he studied in college, but that's where he started reading about Zen. And it is said that that from the moment he walked in to Zen Center LA to the time that he left with his brown robe and on his way to Yonkers to be a Zen teacher was only 5 years. So he was quite single-minded. Maybe he began this practice of profound ease and moment-to-moment attention to just this. So maybe he wasn't so intense, but that's certainly, usually it takes about, you know, close to 20 years. Richard.
Gentle Patrick. That's true. Almost coming out of my talk with Mike Terry and the wonderful team we had, comes this question about no contradiction whatsoever to your teaching of ease, being at the grass hut in the shining light. That's our example. But for me, when the fires are burning north and south, I can never not ask myself, when's the time that it's good for me to be in the hut, and when's the time where I need to go and help fight the fires? Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, there was a similar fire burning at the gates of our beloved Tassajara, and one of the monks who stayed, one of the fire monks, David Zimmerman, after the fire didn't burn down Tassajara, and with the help of those fire monks, he wrote a poem that said, or the title of which is Welcoming the Guest Called Fire. You know, Tassajara is this place where they welcome all the guests there during the summer, and what would it be to just turn so subtly this too is a guest, this great blaze that's caused so much damage, of course, now and even several years ago. Not lives weren't lost around that fire, do you think as a firefighter you could approach that fire as this is the perfect expression of the causes and conditions right now? It's not an enemy. It's just the perfect expression, and yet I want to continue to fight this fire because it's you know, lives are being lost, great suffering is happening, and let me do what I can to relieve suffering here. So it's the subtlest little change from the enemy of fire to the guest called fire, and yet let's work together to relieve all suffering. And I think in in lots of times of stress and discord that we're experiencing, when we feel balled up and tight, can that be our mindfulness bell to, can I face the same situation with openness and intimacy, and see if other solutions might come up that I didn't think about when I was just using my old habits, my old reactions, my old responses. Maybe if I just turn a little bit, if I drop from my head down to my heart, maybe other possibilities will open up. And I think to be able to do that takes great courage, great fearlessness that we have to cultivate day after day right here on the cushion, so that we can be prepared to open our hearts in the face of such suffering. So that's my response. Maybe we can continue outside. May our fearless practice continue to illuminate all things, all people, all situations with the light of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them.